Good morning. I'm Elizabeth Harrison in Providence. It's Friday, May 3rd. Governor Lincoln Chafee has signed legislation legalizing same-sex marriage in Rhode Island. The two bills cleared their final legislative hurdle yesterday. The House vote was 56 to 15. Hundreds of people gathered in front of the statehouse for a signing ceremony. House Speaker Gordon Fox echoed Chafee in calling the long-sought passage of the law a triumph of the lively democratic experiment envisioned by Rhode Island's founders.
It does work. It does work. But in order to work, it needs you and it needs us. You have to make known what your concerns are. You have to be engaged. You have to be involved. You have to stand up.
The new law becomes effective August 1st. Efforts to legalize same-sex marriage in Rhode Island had languished since first introduced in 1997. Observers say the outcome was different this time due to changing public attitudes and a political-style campaign run by supporters. The Tsarnaev family has claimed the body of Boston Marathon bombing suspect Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older brother accused of carrying out the deadly bombing. His Rhode Island widow declined her right to the body. Asma Khalid reports we may soon learn exactly how Tsarnaev died following a shootout with police.
A spokesman for the chief medical examiner's office says Tamerlan Tsarnaev's body was picked up around 5:30 Thursday evening by a funeral service that had been retained by the Tsarnaev family. He would not say which family member had made the arrangements or where the body was taken. Tamerlan Tsarnaev was killed during a gunfight in Watertown 2 weeks ago. The exact cause of Tsarnaev's death has not yet been released. The chief medical examiner's office says a death certificate will be made public after a funeral service files one with the city, and that could happen as early as today.
That's Asma Khalid reporting from Boston. In Warwick, the public had a chance to weigh in yesterday on a plan to close Gorton Junior High School. According to administrators, the school is operating at roughly half its capacity, mainly due to a decline in enrollment. Superintendent Richard D'Agostino argues for closing the school, saying resources now used to maintain the building could be better used for programs that directly help students. Parents and taxpayers, however, have raised concerns about the impact of closing the school. A vote on the closure is scheduled for May 9th. And Rhode Island has the nation's highest concentration of individuals over the age of 85, so it should come as no surprise that we also have a lot of centenarians. Some of them were honored at the governor's annual centenarian brunch, and Rhode Island Public Radio's Flo Jonick was there.
About half of the state's 122 centenarians enjoyed accordion music, brunch, and a visit by Governor Lincoln Chafee at the state's 36th annual Rhode Island Governor Centenarians Brunch. The oldest resident in attendance was 109-year-old Louise Silva of Warwick. She's in frail condition, so her daughter Dorothy spoke for her.
She does pretty well, though. She plays the piano. She eats very well. She reads a lot.
The oldest man in attendance was 105-year-old Joseph Salona. For years, he worked 17 hours a day, 7 days a week, operating a North Providence gas station.
What's the secret to your longevity?
Hard work. Keep going, and that's it.
I asked Governor Chafee if he'd like to live to be 100.
Of course. Everybody's goal. Keep living. What's better?
The governor has a good chance of living a long life. His grandparents survived into their 80s and 90s, and his mom is 86. Flo Jonick, Rhode Island Public Radio.
Thank you. We're joined as usual by Rhode Island Public Radio political analyst Scott McKay. Hello, Scott.
Good morning, Rhode Island.
And University of Rhode Island political science professor Maureen Moakley. Hello, Maureen.
Good morning, everyone.
We're pleased to welcome back as our special guest Roger Williams Law School professor Jorge Alorza. He's also a Providence Housing Court judge and a prospective Providence mayoral candidate. Thanks for joining us, Jorge.
Good morning, Ian. Thank you for having me.
The owner of the vacant Superman building in Providence says it needs $39 million in state help to put the building to a new use, but state leaders showed little appetite for using that level of tax dollars to revive the Superman building. As it stands, the vacant structure has become a symbol of Rhode Island's economic distress. Scott, what do you think should be done to put this building to a productive new use?
Well, it's very difficult. It's a landmark building, and we really don't want to see that building in downtown Providence go dark. It's a beautiful Art Deco, you know, architectural kind of icon in downtown Providence. However, we have to understand that it's the private market. These guys bought this building and they gambled on the lease being renewed, and the lease isn't being renewed. So I think the state and the city should do all they can in a, say, a tax abatement, give them aid. The problem is, I don't think the legislature is going to stand right now for putting taxpayer dollars directly into the pockets of these developers.
What do you think should be done, Jorge?
Well, I agree with Scott. It is a very difficult issue. You know, at the end of the day, the numbers have to work. And you know, those are big numbers that are needed in order to make it work. But I agree, it's a landmark building, and we have to do everything that we can to preserve it as part of our cityscape. With that said, there does seem to be a lot of demand in residential housing downtown, and there is a plan to bring residential housing to that building. And so if something can be done, I hope it is, and I appreciate the fact that people are working with urgency to come up with a plan.
Do you support any level of public dollars to try and put the building to a new use?
You know, the truth is that the devil is in the detail. So, you know, the numbers have to work. What exactly those numbers are, I'm not privy to those figures, so I'll have to reserve comment at this point.
Let's go to Maureen.
Well, I kind of agree with what everyone has said here. I mean, the one thing we have to be careful about is we have to do this right, and it may take a little time, and you may have to leave the lights on. But I do think a mix of tax credits and historic tax credits, as well as some aid. But, you know, when you're talking over $30 million, I don't think there is the stomach in the legislature to do it. And I think we have to wait and see what kind of investment strategy that we can come up with so we can make use of this, probably along residential lines.
One thing that's really needed here is the fixing the downtown bus terminal to make it more attractive.
Let's go to some questions for our special guest, Jorge Elorza. Jorge, you grew up here in Providence, and you're among a large number of people considering running for mayor next year if Angel Taveras seeks a different office. What will you base your decision on, and if so, how will you separate yourself from the other people as a credible candidate?
In all truth, Ian, there's so many chips in the air, as you've mentioned. There's so many people's names who are being considered. And, you know, I'm flattered to be part of that list. But we're just going to have to wait and see how a number of these chips settle over time.
I wanted to follow up on that. One of the things I noticed in the last round when Mayor Taveras ran is that there was a certain amount of cohesion in the Latino community, which I think, you know, united them behind one candidate, while other groups, you know, the Italians, there were several people, you know, running for mayor. In your case, do you feel that that cohesiveness is still there?
Well, perhaps not. You know, I think that the most heartening thing about this entire process is that there are a lot of good people and a lot of good names that are being considered and that are considering this. And I think that we all want what's best for Providence. And, you know, as I mentioned, I think it's very heartening that, you know, good folks are considering this. We want Providence to be in good hands.
Scott, we know City Council President Michael Solomon is going to run if Angel Taveras does move on. And then there's this cast of many other people. How do you see our guest Jorge Elorza fitting into the mix?
Well, obviously, he would have a base, hopefully. And secondly, we don't know yet because the professor has not started raising money. He's not started campaigning. Solomon looks like he wants to be first out of the gate. And, you know, he's the institutional favorite. Certainly, he's got a base in City Hall. He's been elected. And I have to say, Judge Elorza, professor, whatever you prefer, you've never been elected anything. So it would be a real challenge, I think, for you to find a base and get out there and campaign.
Do you want to respond to that, Jorge?
That's one of a number of different factors that are being considered.
Debate continues about the wisdom of putting part of Rodin's almost $8 billion pension fund in hedge funds and other so-called alternative investments. State Treasurer Gina Raimondo calls this a way to stabilize the pension fund's investment returns, but critics say the fees charged by hedge fund managers are too high. Maureen, who do you think is right here, and how do you see the implications of this for the governor's race, assuming Gina Raimondo runs for governor next year?
Well, I think what we see on a number of levels is kind of a full court press to raise these issues and to some sense discredit her. What I can say about what I know about the hedge fund investments is that Ted Nisi did an interesting article that suggested that this was a stabilizing factor, that more and more states were going in this direction. And indeed, the state of Missouri that put a large portion, over 25% of their investments into these kinds of hedge funds has done very well. So the return on that seems to be something that's feasible and prudent thing to do. The question when you get to the fees is another question in terms of that's the going rate, how that plays out, what kind of money that adds up to, could be a force of criticism for her as this campaign rolls along.
And the analysis by our friend Ted Nisi of Channel 12 also found that Raimondo has put Rodon's hedge fund allocation at a level much higher than most other states. Jorge, you worked on Wall Street as an auditor for Price Waterhouse. What is your view on whether this investment in hedge funds makes sense?
Sure. Well, my view on this is pretty straightforward. Gina Raimondo has a background and she has experience in this world, and we elected her precisely to make these kinds of decisions. In terms of how it's going to affect the governor's race, of course, you know, this is something that might pay off extremely well for the state, in which case it'll benefit her, and it's as straightforward. If it doesn't work out, it'll hurt her in the election as well.
What do you say, Scott?
You know, I don't know enough about hedge funds and the casino that is Wall Street to really have an informed opinion. I think a bigger problem is the secrecy that surrounds Engage Rhode Island, these very wealthy people who Gina Raimondo put together to help push this pension deal that they did with the State House. The problem is Mike Corkery, my old friend, a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, broke the story that one of the biggest contributors, somebody who may have given up to $500,000, is an Enron hedge fund guy from Houston. And I just don't know what these people have to do with Rhode Island and why this gentleman is such a big backer of Gina Raimondo. We don't know who these other people are.
Can I just add to that? I mean, let's be a little balanced here in the sense that, of course, she has connections to Wall Street. I mean, she is a venture capitalist. What is she supposed to have? Connections to farmers? I mean, we would expect her to have these kinds of connections and for people to be making contributions based on her expertise.
I have no problem. I just want to know their names.
Meanwhile, in a development that caught political observers by surprise, former Treasurer Frank Caprio is planning to try to regain that office next year. Also, Ernest Almonte, who had been planning to run for governor as a Democrat next year, is now indicating that he might run for treasurer. What's going on here, Scott?
Well, I think Frank Caprio did not like the way that he went out, the famous shove it comment with President Obama. And I think he wants to jumpstart his political career. And that's really all we know at this point. He hasn't been overly forthcoming.
Jorge, what do you make of the reentry into politics of Frank Caprio?
Well, he's a young, relatively young man. He's very capable. He's proven that in the past. And I agree with Scott. You know, this is an ability for him to, you know, reshape or redefine his legacy. And so it just goes to show that nothing's certain, and you never know what to expect in Rhode Island politics.
The last word here to Maureen.
There are second acts in American politics, and I think this is an opportunity for him to get back into the game, and I think he's a talented person.
We're out of time, so we have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us on Roundtable, Scott.
Thank you.
Maureen.
Thank you.
And Roger Williams, law school professor, Providence Housing Court judge, and a potential candidate for mayor of Providence, Jorge Elorza.
Thank you, Ian. It's been a pleasure.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Robertson Foundation, continuing the commitment of its founder, Stephen Hamblett, to honest government in Rhode Island through in-depth political coverage. And if you enjoy the conversation, please visit our On Politics blog at rapr.org.